Hello and welcome to the online sermon content of the Gateway Church of Christ. This is part two on our series on emotionally healthy spirituality. This is actually a re-recording of the sermon that was originally delivered January 15th, 2017. The reason why we're re-recording this is because we want to make sure our listeners get quality content, both that the audio is easy to listen to, easy to hear, and also we believe that the content is quality. We believe that it's worth sharing, it's worth repeating. If you weren't able to be with us that Sunday and you want to catch up on the lessons, or if you were with us that Sunday and you want to revisit this lesson, my prayer is that this lesson would be helpful to you. In part one of this series that we've been doing on emotionally healthy spirituality, we really talked about what it's like to be unhealthy emotionally and spiritually, and we did that by looking at the example of the biblical character of Saul. This week, we want to look at the character of David and what he can teach us about being healthy emotionally and spiritually. Now, this lesson, it really pivots on this question. Who are you? Now, we get asked this question a lot, and we answer it in lots of ways. Typically, you know, we'll answer with our name. If we want to provide more detail, we might talk about what we do for a living, what our job is. If we want to elaborate a little bit, maybe we can talk about what we do in our free time or the people we surround ourselves by. But how much do these answers really tell us about who you are at your core? Think about it this way. How many people do you know who really know you? They really understand you and understand what makes you tick. We can fool those that are closest to us sometimes. You see this in couples who have been together for a long time. Even couples that have been together forever, it seems, sometimes they'll remark, you know, my husband still surprises me, or my wife, I don't understand how she thinks or why she does some of the things that she do. Even the people closest to us sometimes have a hard time understanding the innermost parts of us. But it's not necessarily their fault. We could turn the questions on ourselves. How well do you really know yourself? How well do you truly understand who you are and what makes you tick? A lot of us have struggled with this problem of a false understanding of ourselves or a false sense of self, and I think it is a big problem. Saint Teresa says this. She says, almost all problems in the spiritual life actually stem from a lack of self-knowledge. So the idea is that a lack of a sense of self can cause a lot of problems. If it's such a big problem, what are the symptoms of a false sense of self? Well, there are many. Let me enumerate a few for you. You have this need to be approved by others. Maybe you're constantly comparing yourself to others. Perhaps you even criticize others to feel better about yourselves. Perhaps you desperately want to avoid looking weak or foolish. You definitely don't want to be caught in a situation where you just don't have the right answer. And if you do get caught in a slip-up or if you do make a mistake, you begin to let that define you. You begin to think of yourself as a failure. If people get upset with you, you might get depressed. It might really bother you. And so you might often remain silent in order to keep the peace, in order to not make people upset with you. Perhaps you're acting nice on the outside, but on the inside you're thinking, I really can't stand this person. Or perhaps you keep finding yourself saying yes, yes, yes to things that you really want to say no, no, no to. And we do this for a number of reasons. We might be doing this to appease others or to find some sense of self, but one of the problems with this is that we're not really being our true selves. We're really being an imposter, a false version of ourselves. We might say yes when we really mean no, trying to please and benefit other people, but those people that we're saying yes to, they're not really getting the real us. In some ways, we're doing them a disservice because they're not receiving the real us. They're receiving an imposter version of us. Thomas Merton describes his struggle with the false self this way. I love to clothe this false self, he says. I wind experiences around myself with pleasures and glory, like they were bandages in order to make myself visible to the world. It's as if I was an invisible body that could only become visible when something else covered my surface. But underneath, there is no substance under these things of which I clothe myself. I am hollow, and when they are gone, there will be nothing left of me except my own nakedness and hollowness and emptiness. It's a powerful picture. If you're familiar with the classic science fiction story by H.G. Wells, The Invisible Man, it's also been adapted into numerous films, you're familiar with that man that's wrapped in bandages, that he can peel away the bandages and there appears to be nobody underneath. And I think this is a good way to think of the symptoms and the problems of having a false sense of self. If we're to really look inward, if we're to peel back our layers to see what's in our heart of hearts and what really drives us and makes us tick, are we able to see what's at our core? Or do we see something hollow and emptied? Do we really have a good sense of self at the core of us? It's not unsimilar to what we hear in one of the earliest biblical stories, the story of the fall and Adam and Eve in the garden. Now, there was a time when Adam and Eve, they certainly knew who they are. They had a good sense of self. They're in paradise and they even get to walk and talk with God. However, because of their choice to sin, and it brings sin and the consequences of sin into this world, one of the first ways that this manifests in them is where they were once naked and not ashamed of who they are, suddenly they feel compelled to clothe themselves and to hide from God, and they start turning on each other. A false sense of health can be toxic to our relationship with God and our relationships with others. John Calvin puts it this way: the vast majority of us go to our graves without really knowing who we are. We unconsciously live somebody else's life, or at least someone else's expectations for us. And this does violence to ourselves, our relationships with God, and ultimately to others. I think that's true. I think we, like our first parents, Adam and Eve, are afraid to look at ourselves or perhaps ashamed of it. We try to cover ourselves, but this only does violence to ourselves, to others, and to our relationship with God. And we do this for a number of reasons. Perhaps we don't have a sense of self just because we just don't have an understanding about who we are, or perhaps there are outside forces that are putting pressures on us to conform to a mold that really isn't us. Now, to illustrate this, I have a clip from the movie How to Train Your Dragon. It's a conversation between a Viking father and son about the son beginning training to start killing dragons. Now, watch the dynamics here, and we'll see if this is emotionally healthy.
I don't want to fight dragons. Come on, yes you do. Rephrase. Dad, I can't kill dragons.
But you will kill dragons.
No, I'm really very extra sure that I won't.
It's time, Hiccup.
Can you not hear me?
This is serious, son. When you carry this axe, you carry all of us with you. Which means you walk like us, you talk like us, you think like us. No more of this.
You just gestured to all of me.
Deal?
This conversation is feeling very one-sided.
Deal!
Dale.
Have you ever been a part of a conversation like that? Or maybe it's not as explicit as that is. Have you ever been a part of a group or one way or another, explicitly or implicitly, you feel the pressure to conform? It's communicated to you one way or the other that if you're going to be a part of us, you've got to walk like us, you've got to talk like us, you've got to think like us, even at the expense of having less of this, less of you, who you really are. And oftentimes we do try to, we give in to those pressures and we conform to the social pressures of our group. Now, psychologists talk about this when they talk about family systems theory. And it doesn't have to be your family of origin. It can apply to any social group that you're a part of and how you negotiate those relationships and how it affects your sense of self. What they say you need to remain emotionally healthy is this concept called differentiation. And I'm going to give you the definition of differentiation here by Pete Scazzaro. He's the guy that wrote the book on emotionally healthy spirituality. He defines it like this. Differentiation involves the ability to hold on to who you are and who you are not. The degree to which you are able to affirm your distinct values and goals apart from the pressures around you, while remaining close to the people important to you, that's what helps determine your level of differentiation. And so this is important. Differentiation is a good thing. People that have a high degree of differentiation, it doesn't mean that they can't be a part of a group or can't work to be a part of a family or some kind of a social circle like that. It's just that they can be a part of a group without losing their sense of self. They don't have to isolate themselves to hold on to them their true sense of self. And also, when they become immersed in a group, they don't lose their sense of self. You're able to be separate and together. At least a differentiation person is. Pete Scazzaro continues, people with a high level of differentiation have their own beliefs, convictions, directions, goals, and values, all apart from the pressures around them. And I think this is key. He talks about how it manifests during disagreements. I may not agree with you, or you with me, yet I can remain in relationship with you still. I don't have to detach from you. I don't have to reject you, avoid you, or criticize you in order to validate myself. I can be myself apart from you. And this is important. Whether we have a false sense of self because of the pressures that are put on us, or just because we haven't really found our true sense of self yet, it's important to be ourselves rather than to be somebody else. There's a Hasidic rabbi, Zusia. When he was an old man, he said this. He said, in the coming world, they will not ask me, why were you not Moses, right? Why were you not that great rabbi? Instead, they will ask me, why were you not Zusia? The part about being emotionally and spiritually healthy that we're talking about, it's very similar to the advice that the genie gives Aladdin. Be yourself. It's very important to our emotional health and our spiritual health to be ourselves. Now, we're Christians. We're about being spiritually healthy in addition to being emotionally healthy. How does this connect with God? Meister Eckhart says this. He says, no one can truly know God who does not first know himself. Or Augustine puts it this way, how can you draw close to God when you are far from your own self? And so he prays this prayer. Grant, Lord, that I may know myself, that I may know thee. These guys are making the argument that knowledge of God and knowledge of self are interconnected, and you can't know the one without knowing the other. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. The more we let God take us over, the more truly ourselves we become, because he made us. He invented us. He invented all the different people that you and I were intended to be. It is when I turn to Christ, when I give up myself to his personality, that I first begin to have a real personality of my own. As opposed to the pressures that can be put on us from a group, from a family, from a spouse. They don't understand us like God understands us. They didn't make us. God made us. God knows the kind of people that we're meant to be. God knows the kind of people we are at the core. And turning ourselves over to God, that can really help us find who we truly are. As Lewis says, it's like this is when we can begin to have a real personality of our own. One more quote from John Calvin. He puts it this way. He says, our wisdom consists almost entirely of these two parts. One, the knowledge of God, and two, the knowledge of ourselves. But these are connected together by many ties, and it's not easy to determine which of the two precedes and gives birth to the other. So, we as Christians know that the fear of the Lord, to know God, is the beginning of wisdom. It's very important that we know God. Philosophers and psychologists will say, like, it's very important to know thyself. You have to know yourself. And knowing God and knowing yourself, both very important things, we're trying to make the case that these things are connected. And you can come at it from the approach of, like, we need to know God that you may know yourself, as Lewis argues. Or if you buy what John Calvin is saying, that these two things are so interconnected, you can come at it from both ways. You can even say, as Augustine too prayed, know yourself that you may know God. And this is the title of the lesson that we're doing today. Know yourself that you may know God. And to illustrate this, we're going to look at the story of David, perhaps the most famous story of David. We're going to look at the story of David and Goliath. We're going to be reading from 1 Samuel 17, and in the text, it's just going to say the Philistine. I want to be clear, whenever it says the Philistine, it's referring to Goliath. Now, just some quick context for the story. So Goliath and the Philistines are challenging Israel. Goliath comes out to taunt the Israelite soldiers. If one of you comes out and fights me and wins, we'll become your slaves. But if I kill your champion, you will become our slave. And Goliath, as we all know, is a very intimidating opponent. So intimidating, in fact, that despite all the taunting, none of the Israelite soldiers, none of the people in Saul's army are willing to fight Goliath. David, his brothers, are on these front lines, and he goes to visit them and to bring them some supplies. He hears Goliath taunting, and he starts asking around. He's like, hey, what's going to happen to the guy that does these things? He starts talking like he's considering taking on Goliath, and this is where I want to begin our lesson. 1 Samuel 17, starting in verse 28. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men about what's going to happen when he kills Goliath, he burned with anger at him, and he asked, why have you come down here, and with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Now, the text told us before that David came down here on his father's orders. He was being obedient. And it also says that he was diligent. He didn't leave the sheep unprotected. He left them with an attendant. Why is Eliab throwing out these accusations? Why does he say that David's heart is conceited and wicked and he just came here to watch the battle? Why is Eliab reacting this way? It's because David has triggered something in Eliab. Eliab has been enduring this abuse from Goliath and has he's been afraid to act like David is considering acting right here, and that threatens Eliab's sense of self-worth. And so he's lashing out of David, not because of what David doing anything wrong, but because of what's going on in Eliab. I feel like I could take Eliab and I could point him at a white blank wall and I could play a movie off of him because he's projecting so hard. He doesn't want to fight Goliath so bad that he's projecting that onto David. You don't really want to fight. You came here just to watch the battle. Why don't you get out of here? Because you're threatening my sense of self-worth. Now, to give you a little more contents, it's somewhat understandable why maybe Eliab would be jealous of David. In the preceding chapter, 1 Samuel 16, we have this episode. Last week, the first lesson on emotionally healthy spirituality, we learned about Saul falling out of favor with God, and God deciding that he would anoint a new king. His spirit would pass from Saul and go to somebody else, and the Lord sends Samuel out to anoint a new king, and Samuel comes to David's family. And this is what happens, starting in 1 Samuel 16:6. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab, this older brother that just chewed David out. And Samuel thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things that people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. To go back to that image of how we can clothe ourselves with these with these false things that we define ourselves by and these false masks, that might fool other people, but not the Lord who sees our hearts, not the Lord who made us, who authored us, who knows who we really are underneath and who we're intended to be. So, verse 8, then Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel, but Samuel said, "The Lord has not chosen this one either." And then Jesse sends the rest of his sons to pass before Samuel, and Samuel says to him, "You know, the Lord hasn't chosen any of these." Verse 11, so Samuel asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" And Jesse says, "There's still the youngest, I guess. He's tending the sheep." Samuel says, "Send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives." It seems like David's family was kind of dismissive of him. Surely, Samuel, you wouldn't want to see the runt of the litter. Samuel says, "No, we're not going to move forward until David gets here." So they sent for him, and we see, starting in verse 12, he was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord says, "Rise and anoint him. This is the one." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. You can understand why his brothers might have some resentment. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully on David. Samuel sees that this person that's been discarded, that there's true value in this person that the Lord recognizes, that even his family, this close system, cannot see, or that they're blind and oblivious to. So let's go back to 1 Samuel 17 and let's see how David deals with Eliab projecting on him and accusing him with all these things. Let's see what David does here. 1 Samuel 17, starting in verse 29. "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. David recognizes, he says, What did I do? What did I say? Like, I didn't do anything to wrong you, Eliab. He recognizes that this problem is coming from Eliab, not from David himself. And so David kind of just disengages. And that is a really emotionally healthy thing to do, if you can recognize that and say, you know what, there's something else going on here that, like, it's really not on me. I can't solve this problem. You need to work on this problem. We're going to see David come into conflict with two other individuals, and we'll see how he handles it and what that can teach us about being healthy, both emotionally and spiritually. So let's continue. In verse 31, Saul hears what David is saying, and so Saul sends for David. Verse 32, David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine, that is Goliath. Your servant," meaning David, "will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, and it struck it, and rescued the sheep from its very mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it." Now, so David's saying, it's like, listen, I've got some experience. I've at shepherding, I've been managed to defend the flock against bears and lions. Now, some people might say, Saul might retort, "David, that's a little bit of apples and oranges. It's one thing, it's impressive to fight these ferocious beasts, but Goliath it's a different league. It's a different ballpark." But this is what David says, starting in verse 36. "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like them." David doesn't see the difference because of this. Starting in verse 37, "The Lord, who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." It's not that Goliath isn't more intimidating than the bear or the lion. Goliath could probably kill many lions and bears, but David realizes it's not about the bear, it's not about the lion, it's about the person who delivered him from these threats, who helped him overcome these obstacles. That's what gives David his sense of self here. That's what informs him of these things. And so this is how Saul responds to David. He says, Go, and the Lord be with you. And then immediately, verse 38, then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. And this is a funny picture. You can imagine a younger man with this oversized armor of an older man, and it just doesn't fit. And this is another characteristic thing of Saul, where he says one thing, yes, go, the Lord be with you, and then he immediately turns around and kind of contradicts himself. He says, go, yeah, if you have the Lord with you, that'll be enough, but then he immediately tries to put his own stamp on this young man of David, right? Let's see just how other people can try to clothe us with their stamp or a different sense of self. But this is how David responds. I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took a staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in his shepherd's bag with his sling in his hand, and approached the Philistine. Now, I think it's interesting here. He gets rid of the things he's not used to, and he goes back to those things that he is used to. His staff, his shepherd's bag, his sling. He's going to stick with the formula that's been proven to him. And so now on to David's final conflict in this text. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him, this is verse 41, he keeps coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, kind of similar to what Samuel recognized in David when he first saw him. And Goliath despised him. Verse 43, he said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, who you have defiled. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give you the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals. This trash talk has gotten pretty brutal, but it has a purpose, and this is what the purpose is. David says, so that the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by the sword or the spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. And as so many of us know, the giant soldier Goliath comes charging at David, but David is able to take him down by slinging a small stone into his head. It's one of the greatest underdog stories, one of the greatest upsets, one of the greatest underdog stories ever told. Now, it's worth noting that Goliath is killed by the stone, but David doesn't leave it there. He takes Goliath's great sword, and he cuts off Goliath's head, and then in verse 54, it says this, David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, supposedly to be a trophy of triumph over there, but he put the Philistine's weapon in his own tent. Hold on to this. This is going to come up later. And so we see how David handled himself in these three different conflicts. And what's a common theme there? The common theme there is that David's sense of self comes from what he knows about God. That's what informs who he really is. He knows himself because he knows God, or vice versa. We see this in a lot of the other things that David writes. David, as we know, wrote several psalms. There's one psalm I want to use in particular to demonstrate this, Psalm 139, which is a psalm of David. He says this about how God understands them. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is even on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in from behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, and I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I am awake, I am still with you. It's a beautiful psalm. David marvels at how much God knows him. That even before David was, even before David knew himself, God knew him. God knit him together in his mother's womb. God ordained all the days of David's life before David lived one day. And David thinks about how much God knows him, and he says, such knowledge too wonderful for me to obtain. How precious are these thoughts? He marvels at how much God knows him. And that informs his sense of self-worth and who he is. He says, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. So what are the applications for these lessons? I've got a threefold application for you, and we will conclude this lesson in just a few minutes. This week, I would encourage you to spend some time in quiet prayer and meditation. And I say quiet prayer and meditation, quiet because, again, there are so many pressures and distractions that can cloud our judgment and cloud our understanding of ourselves. So try to find some time for silence, for quiet meditation, and prayer because you want to bring God into that conversation because God knows who you are and who you're intended to be better than you do. And so, threefold application. In quiet prayer, I want you to meditate on these three things. First, think on that the God who created and knows everything is the God who created you and the God who knows you. It's worth thinking about. The God who made everything there is, the universe and everything it is, and understands its secrets that we don't understand, that is beyond us. He created you, and he understands the secret parts of you that even you don't understand. A good way to think about this is from this book, Just in Case You Ever Wonder, by Max Lucado. It was one of my favorite books that my parents would read to me as a child. There's this one passage in here that has really stuck with me. Long, long ago, God made a decision, a very important decision, one that I'm really glad he made. He made the decision to make you. The same hands that made the stars made you. The same hands that made the canyons made you. The same hands that made the trees and the moon and the sun made you. That's why you are special, because God made you. It's worth thinking about. If you've ever looked up at the night sky and with this sense of wonder, or at the mountains or at the valleys or at any part of creation, and marveled at how wonderfully made they are. It's worth thinking of that the author of those things made you. You are fearfully and wonderfully made. The second thing I ask you to meditate on would be this. Meditate and remember that God has anointed you. Now, we saw in the story of David how he was anointed by Samuel and how the Spirit of the Lord affected him heavily because of that. We too, church, as Christians, are anointed. This is our last passage I want to share with you. It's from 2 Corinthians 1, starting at verse 20, and it goes like this. No matter how many promises God has made, they are yes in Christ, so that through him the amen is spoken by us to the glory of God. Now, it is God who makes both us and you stand firm in Christ. He anointed us. He set his seal of ownership on us and put his Spirit in our hearts as a deposit guaranteeing what is to come. We've been anointed. We have been sealed. We got God's stamp of approval. And it can't be taken away from us. It's a deposit guaranteeing our inheritance. It's worth remembering, church, that God has anointed us and God's made promises to us, and God will deliver on those promises. There's yes to those promises. It's worth thinking that God has anointed us. And finally, last thing I would ask you to meditate on is remember how God has delivered you throughout your story. To revisit this idea of David, he talks about the God who delivered me from the claw of the bear and the paw of the lion will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. It's worth remembering that while David took Goliath's head to Jerusalem, he took Goliath's sword to his own tent. I imagine we can speculate that David also kept in his tent the paw of a lion and the claw of a bear. Because David was intentional about remembering the ways that God has delivered him and the way that God has allowed him to overcome obstacles. And so that's the application for this lesson. Spend some time this week in quiet prayer and meditate on these three things: that the God who created and knows everything created and knows you, that God has anointed you with a special anointing, and remember how God has delivered you and helped you in the past. This, church, is my prayer that you would do these things. My prayer is that you may know God, that you may know yourself, and that you may know yourself, that you may know God. God bless you all.